accession number 31509, Rule 16.
Gavin Douglas, Reel 16. I know this is fast forwarding, Gavin, and I hope you're going to tell us how you met up with Anne at the end of this interview. But I wondered what you think of the legacy of the British in India from your own experience. You know, were there positive aspects to this, do you think?
Well, it's a very difficult question to answer, because there's no doubt about it. We never intended in the first place to rule India. It was the trading companies that went in there, first of all. Keep it very short, very simple. And they only got involved in a political and physical military way, because India in those days, the early days of John Company, was not a country that was basically one country. It was a mass of different areas with struggles going on, rulers against rulers, a lot of marauding parties out for their own power. India was a bit of a mess. One has to go right back into history. But it really all started after the Mughal invasions from the northwest, through the northwest frontier. They came from Central Asia, and there was this was the Islamic side of India that came into a country where there were millions of more Hindus than there were Muslims. At my time, when I was there, we had an internal security situation. And it was always, and it was not against for our own protection so much as for keeping the peace between Hindus and Muslims. And this internal situation was such that things would clear up so easily. For example, there was this question of the cow and the pig. The cow is Hindu, is sacred to the Hindu, and the pig is the most defiled creature on the face of the earth, according to the Muslims. If you wanted to really upset a Hindu, you went and kicked a cow or behaved badly, something like that. If you wanted to really upset a Muslim, you drove a pig into his mosque, and that they saw red. Each side, depending on who was doing what to whom. And the British Army was called in time and time again to separate this fighting. And it was all part of the internal security situation, because when things did get out of hands, well, then you got the Gundas and the people from the bazaars who had come out, the scum, whose main object was to profit from insurrections of this sort, and loot. That was one of the good things the British did. They controlled that. Another good thing that the British did after we had, in a sense, had India had become the jewel in the crown, so to speak, was that we built roads. But more than that, we built railways. Railways opened up India enormously. It was a very diverse country, both in people and climates and food and everything. Before, it was pockets of this and pockets of that, and pockets of great poverty and pockets of nothing. The railways opened up India, north to south, east to west. Then, to help the agricultural people in the Punjab, we built all those canals for them. The British all the time were doing what I would call a clean-up job. And although there might have been the odd rotten apple amongst us, by and large, the Brits were very honest. There was no finagling with finances. They didn't lie. British, in those days, an Englishman's word was law, and the courts, the Indians love litigation. They're always litigating over land or women or something of the sort. And the man who had told the best lies or had the most money was the person who usually won. law was to me, anyway, what I read and saw, was not upheld in the way it should be. It was only the British magistrates and the ICS and people like that who tried to and successfully succeeded in rooting out all these problems that were caused by the way people lived and the way they thought and acted amongst the Indians. A British magistrate, for an example, would hear lots of cases and petitions would be made. But before the petition could get to his desk, to him, or he'd see somebody, the chaprasi outside his office door had to have his hand greased. Well, all along the line, there was an awful lot of money changing hands before you could get to see the person you really wanted to see. I'm putting this very badly, but basically it was lousy and dishonest, in my opinion. And the British did an awful lot to cleaning all that up. And I'm proud to say that there was no peculation. We were not allowed to accept presents. And, of course, bribes were rampantly offered in India and passed between the Indians. And many Britons, attempts were made to bribe them. And they turned down this bribery and corruption that went along with it. We didn't make ourselves popular by not following the customs of the country. And, of course, there were many people who took advantage of the fact that we were rather a thorn in their sides to try and run us down and revile us, often with lying stories, not accusing anybody of accepting bribes, because they knew there was no good, it wouldn't work, nobody would believe it, because they knew the British did not accept bribes. But we were an alien force, let's face it. India, after we'd built railways and brought India together as a big country, although it had very many different kinds of races and many, many more different languages in India than there are in Europe, nevertheless, there was a growing sentiment of nationality in India. And thanks to us, we brought it on ourselves in a sense, but the way things were, that was modern life, how things were developing.
Yes, I suppose you, by the use of English, it unified the country, did it? The English language, did you find that
very
important?
Much so, very much so. Now, the great majority of Indians were the untouchables. We offered them opportunities which they could not get from their own people. So I would say, on that simple basis, we were not unpopular with the majority of Indians. But we were very unpopular with those Indians who wanted to seek power for themselves. Of course, they were the ones who were ruling the country, or were ruling their own areas, and were eventually formed the Indian National Congress. And, of course, their aim was to get the British out and to get India under control themselves. And I must say, we had great fears about things going backwards if they did that. I'm glad to say that that was not the case. They have done a remarkable job since that, since they've got their independence. And there is still corruption in the courts, of course, but where is there not corruption, of course? I think the Indians have done, since independence, it was a shambles at first, but since independence and present times, I think they've made enormous progress in every way. Their army, which is, and the Air Force, which are modeled on the British Army, is very, very efficient and very independent of politics. And I take my hat off to the way they're running their country now.
Yes, I suppose Pakistan would be a different matter, wouldn't it, from India?
Well, they were all originally Indians, but it's a question of religion, you see. And even amongst in Pakistan, they're all Islamic. You've got the Shias and the Sunnis. And they're always at each other's throats. In Pakistan, again, in one way they've done as well as India, but in Pakistan, they're all backstabbing each other. Every president who comes to the fore, whether he's martial law or through political means voted in, is no sooner in than the rest are all saying, well, who is he? I mean, he's only so-and-so, we knew him. And the next thing is they're backstabbing and they want his job. It's a strange situation. There are, of course, as in every country, there are Pakistanis who are really marvellous people, and I have had many very good friends in Pakistan and in India, but there seems to be a sickness in Pakistan, and I'm afraid to say I think I'm putting it down mostly to their religious squabbles, particularly the Shia and Sunni business.
Were you surprised when the East Pakistan broke away from the West in 1970, wasn't it? 1971?
No, not at all. The Bengali and the Patana was different as chalk from cheese.
Seems a very strange arrangement when one thinks of the distance between those two areas.
Yes, well, you see, most of the Bengalis, East Pakistanis, were Islamic, were Muslims. And the others, of course, had all gone to West Pakistan. Quite a lot of Muslims stayed in India and have not had any problems, but they were always afraid, of course, that the Hindus, being a majority, would get the best jobs and that they would be second-class cousins. But
I've often wondered, you know, with people like yourself and Anne as well, who spent so many years in India, and you obviously love the country from what you've been saying, and, you know, you have great friends with the people. How easy was it to come back to a country like Britain and settle here? Do you find that the British people understand your experience and feeling for India?
I think a few people do and are interested. I think the great majority couldn't care less. That's my short-term thought about it. It's too far away, and England now has become a very selfish country. Each person only out for himself. They want to be a 5-minute celebrity. They all want money. They don't want to work. The England of today is not the England of my boyhood. That's maybe thanks to two wars, when most of the best people were killed in the First World War, or would have produced children who were like themselves, and those who there were not as many casualties in the Second World War. We lost the creme de la creme in that war. We've got the scum that's left.
I know I'm going to have the pleasure of interviewing Anne at some date, but it would be interesting to ask you, because you have explained earlier that you met her at when she was a very young girl, before the war started, and here you are married. How did that come about, Gavin?
Well, I'll keep it as short as possible. It's not a very long story because of big gaps. When I arrived out in India to be an ADC to the governor, I was also adjutant of the bodyguard. And it so happened that her father, who had died when she was only 12 years of age, had also been in the bodyguard as adjutant and later became commandant. I arrived in August in Madras of 1938 to take up the appointment as ADC to Lord Erskine, and Anne arrived in September, and she was a young girl. She had her 17th birthday on the ship, and her father and mother, her stepfather incidentally, had also been in the army at Gallipoli with her father in the First World War, and they had both courted her mother, and her father, her real father, had married her mother. When he died, after two or three years, her stepfather proposed to her mother, and they had both been in love with her and married her, so she became she had a stepfather who treated her exactly as though he was his own daughter. She was an only child. Well, she was completely and utterly innocent, as all girls were at that age. She'd been to a Scottish school, a girls' school, of course. She knew nothing whatsoever about sex or anything, but girls didn't in those days. My own sister was the same. It happened that there was a big ball at Government House in Madras one November, the first November. She'd only been in the country for 2 months, and I'd been in for 3 months in Madras. And her parents were on the Government House list, of course. They were both senior citizens in Madras, and they were allowed to bring their young daughter, albeit only 17, to this big ball. One of the many jobs of an ADC is to look after people at the functions like this, and as a ball, one had to make sure that nobody was left sitting out by themselves, not dancing when everybody else was dancing. And I noticed that this girl was sitting by herself on one wall, and everybody else was dancing. I couldn't find a partner for her. There were a few men who weren't dancing, but they were busy talking or drinking. So I went up to her and I bowed and I asked if she would care to dance, and she nodded her head and got up, and we danced. Well, the extraordinary thing is that she was shaking like a leaf to me. I knew nothing about her. She knew how to dance, but then she'd been to a girls' school where they had had a gramophone and a piano, and they had danced with each other. And there was nothing she didn't know about waltzing and foxtrotting and quick-stepping and all that sort of thing, because, of course, the girls used to dance with each other. It's my turn to be the man, you be the woman, and vice versa. So she knew, there was no question of stumbling around on the floor or being awkward. She knew how to dance. But she had never been held in a man's arms in her life, albeit very loosely and at a great distance from each other and very decorously. But it affected her. Well, I saw her several times in the following 2 years before I left the job because war had broken out. And we didn't meet again until after the war, when I had joined the shipping company. She suddenly appeared in Bombay and was having a second child. She had got married in the meantime, at the end of the war, and I was also married. So we met as young married couples, and I didn't see her again for 60 years. In about 1999 or 1998, she read some articles I had written for army magazines, Indian Army magazines, and she saw the name Gavin Douglas. She quite liked an article that I had written, and she wrote to the editor and said, "I wonder if this is the Gavin Douglas I used to know." And he said, "If you send the letter, I'll have it forwarded." At that time, I had retired from everything. I'd come back from America, where I'd lived for the last 16 years, and was staying in an officer's home in Devon when I received this letter saying, "Do you remember me?" and all that thing. Well, of course I did. And we used to speak to each other every day on the phone, usually about 8 o'clock in the evening after our supper was over at the officer's home. And eventually, after about 6 or 7 months, she said, "Why don't you come up and see me?" And I said, "Well, you come down and see me first." So she came down to Devon, we put her up, and she stayed for about a week. And that I so much liked what I saw of her, and I felt I'd known her all of my life, although we hadn't met for years and years and years. It seemed so natural to see more of her. And when she said, "Well, why don't you come up to Sussex, and perhaps we could live together?" So I gave up my place in the officer's home in Devon and came up to Lewes. And for the first year or two, she took my name by deed poll, so it looked respectable, and we lived as man and wife. And after a couple of years, we decided we'd get married. And we've been married very happily ever since.
Yes. Well, that's a lovely romantic note to end on, Gavin. Mm. And thank you very much indeed for telling me, on behalf of the museum, so much about your very interesting life. And, you know, particularly your service life, but yes, much more. And I know that I'm going to look forward to reading the rest of your book.
Well,
and I hope the museum have a copy of this.
Well, if I live long enough to write it, because there's an awful lot yet to write. And I am feeling very tired sometimes these days. And I also find when I'm tired, I can't write.
How old are you now?
93 and a half.
Yes, well, if I might say so, you certainly don't seem 93
no,
and a half.
I've really only begun to feel like I am now at this age in the last 3 years since I got prostate cancer of the prostate. This has really taken the stuffing out of me. Up till then, 3 years ago, I could drive all around Europe for months on end, and I didn't feel tired or the ill effects. I could do this 2 or 3 times a year, very active, and bless her, was also extremely active up until only 2 or 3 weeks ago when she went down with the virus, and she's taking a long time to recover from it.
Well, I do wish you both well, Gavin, and may you have many more years of
happiness together. Well, thank you
very much.
I would like to live to be over 96, because the longest living of any of my predecessors back to the 11th century lived to 96. Most of us died at much earlier ages, and the earlier ancestors, many of them were killed in battle at 15 to 16 years of age in the struggle between England and Scotland in the Scottish Wars of Independence.